Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hazen, I'm an alcoholic. To begin with, I'd like to welcome all the new people that had enough courage to stand up and introduce themselves by their first name. I'd like to welcome the two people who aren't sure whether they're alcoholics or not. I also like to welcome anyone else who's in their first 30 days who is a little bit too scared to stick up their hand and introduce themselves. And I want you to know that we welcome you and we have a deep understanding of you and your problem. For those of you who aren't sure, listen up. Don't take nothing and keep coming back until you find out for sure. It's a real trip. It's a pleasure. It's an honor to be here tonight, sober. Do you know how many people in the room tonight know the name of the holiday, the official name of the holiday that we're going to celebrate tomorrow? Raise your hand. What is it? President's Day. No? See, somebody fucked up. It's President's Day. Okay, by President's Day now, what we do is we used to have A.B. the Link one day and Georgie the Wash the next day, right? And now what they did is they combined them and they celebrate President's Day. Great, great day, great holiday. George Washington, first president, father of our country. And Abraham Lincoln, the 16th president of the United States. Did you know, how many people in here knew that Abraham Lincoln was an alcoholic? A mountain of useless information. Abraham Lincoln was indeed an alcoholic. He was an alcoholic of the worst kind. He was a periodic. He used to wander off from the White House and get fucked up, you know. Yeah, he used to do that behind the log cabin and all that shit. Yeah, and then he'd come back and he had them blackouts, didn't know what he did, you know, like so many of us. I know he's an alcoholic because one time he came back from a drunk, went back to the White House, he said, I freed who? Yeah. Takes a lot of sobriety and guts to tell a story like that. I'll tell you, rule 187B in AA is don't take yourself too seriously, and I have a God-given sense of humor, and it's made a survivor out of me. Oh, yeah, I smell everything I drink, yeah. Yeah, they put it in front of me all covered up very nicely. I still smell it. I don't care if I'm in the company of Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. I'm going to smell my drink. Let's get on with it. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like now. And I've got two messages for you tonight. The first message is please don't do it my way. And secondly, trust in God and clean house because that's what it tells me to do in this book. By this book, I'm talking about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was born and raised on the south side of Chicago in a Polish, Italian, Roman Catholic, Democratic neighborhood. And if you weren't Polish, Catholic, Italian, Roman Catholic, or Democrat, you're in the wrong neighborhood. Just that simple. And I was a product of an alcoholic mother and a very ignorant, uninformed father. And when I say ignorant, uninformed, he was a self-made man, self-educated man, very bright man. But he's very ignorant and uninformed in the way of alcohol and alcoholism. So we didn't know nothing about that when I came up. And my mother was not an alcoholic. See, my mother was not an alcoholic. She was a drunken slut in the vernacular of the neighborhood. But people didn't say that out loud because if me or my old man or my brother heard it, we put some hurting on their ass, you understand? So that was said behind her back and our backs. And I do have a brother. He's 5 years my junior. And he and I were literally raised in terror and fear because of the experiences and feelings that we experienced while watching my father try to fix my mama. See, my papa tried to fix my mama the way he tried to fix everything else in this world, see. And that was with this, see. My dad is 6'5" and weighs 250 pounds. He's big enough to stand in a fucking manger and eat hay. And he bounced my mama around a lot. One night I remember very vividly, too vividly in fact, because I get very emotional when I talk about my mother. But I was about 10 years old. And one night I heard some screaming coming from the kitchen about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I leaped out of the bunk bed and I ran into the kitchen. And my mom was laying on the kitchen floor naked, and her nose was all busted out and her teeth were knocked out. And my father just got through throwing her a beating with a belt and a belt buckle. And he had her hair. See, my mother was a former Miss St. Louis in the beauty contest when she was 19 years old. She was a gorgeous human being, a beautiful physical specimen. She was just a drunk. And my dad had her hair, her long auburn hair, and he had a butcher knife, and he was hacking off her hair, and he says, "You son of a bitch, I'll keep you home." And I jumped on my father's back, and I says, "Pa," he says, "Man, you know, come on, don't be hitting Ma like that." And he gave me a shot, and I wound up on my ass in the corner, and I went to bed, and I was scared. I was terrified. I had a lot of feelings when I was a kid. Fear. Terror. Hate. Resentment. Revenge. I was 10 years old, and because of my mother's irresponsible practicing alcoholic behavior, I had the responsibilities of an adult in our household. I had to do all the shopping. I had to do all the laundry. I had to do all the house cleaning. I did all the cooking. 10 years old. Because my mom couldn't handle it. She was a practicing alcoholic. My father couldn't give my mother a dime. She'd drink it. That very morning, that very early morning that I shared with you about my mother catching a beating, I went back to bed, and at 5:30 my old man went to work like he did every fucking day of his life on time. And at 6 o'clock when the saloons opened up, my mom put an old coat on and a babushka on her head. And she went down to the store, she went down to the saloon, and she came back with some booze and a fucking uncle. She always come home with another uncle. See, my mother was a real alcoholic, as described in this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on page 21 in chapter 3. The reason I share this was just very meaningful to me. And I guess the main reason I share it with you is because of the insidiousness of this disease that I have called alcoholism, in spite of everything that I saw and everything that I felt as a child, I too became an alcoholic. See, alcohol don't give a fuck who you are. It don't care if you're black, white, brown, green, blue, pink, or purple, Italian, Polish, Spanish, Mexican, Puerto Rican, don't give a fuck. If you live in Los Altos, you come off the street. If you're an alcoholic and you keep fucking with it, it's going to kick your ass. And it did it to my mama. And you'll hear a little bit of what it did to me. When I was a kid, my old man only wanted two things for me to do. To go to school, get an education, and play ball. And he wanted me to play football because he wanted me to get a college scholarship so I could get out of the neighborhood. It was the only way we could get out of the neighborhood in those days. Nowadays, a lot of people take a reverse pride and say, "Hey, man, I come from the ghetto, Jim. I lived in the ghetto. Can you dig it? I lived in the fucking ghetto, too, only we didn't call it a ghetto. We call it the neighborhood. We all had the same thing, nothing, you know. It don't take much to make a bunch of dagos and Polacks happy. Give them an old tin can, they play tin can, and they're happy, you know. I went to a grammar school, a Roman Catholic grammar school called Our Lady of Perpetual Guilt. And that's where I found my initial spiritual beliefs. And later on, I went to high school. And I went to a school in Chicago called Tilden Technical High School. It had 6,000 boys and no girls. We used to have 2,000 guys come out for football. We had some ass-wiping teams in those days, I'm here to tell you. Tilden has won more city championships in the city of Chicago than any other school in history, although we weren't the largest. I made that team as a sophomore. I lettered as a sophomore, a junior, and a senior. My senior year, I was all city and honorable mention all state. And I wound up with 28 college offers. I graduated from high school when I was 16 years old. I've been drinking since I was 15. I was sort of, well, you know, the old dope fiends, the old gangsters in the old neighborhood, they used to call Jerry Poppin jacking off with dope. They used to, you know, Jerry Poppin was what they called jacking off with dope. And that's what I did. That's what I did with alcohol. I never got no serious problem before I graduated from high school. But I knew I was an alcoholic from the gate. Because every time I got drunk, I was the guy that always got sick, got in a fight, got in some kind of a hassle. You know what I mean? Because alcohol just took over. I was 16 years old and received all these college scholarships, and one of them was from the University of Notre Dame, which is located in South Bend, Indiana, 60 miles from my neighborhood. So I went to Notre Dame and I worked out with the freshman team. They had freshman ball in those days, and I had a hell of a day. And two weeks later, the coach, Frank Leahy, and the athletic director, Moose Krause, came to my kitchen, my mother's kitchen, my drunken mother's kitchen, and I sat down and I signed a letter of national intent to go to the University of Notre Dame. My father was the happiest Polack in captivity. Because his kid was finally going to play for Notre Dame. All that happened when I was 16 years old. The day I turned 17, I didn't walk. I ran down and joined the United States Marine Corps. For one reason only. Patriotism was in those days. The Korean thing was just popping. And besides that, I want to get back at my papa for all the hurt he had done to my mama. I joined the Marine Corps, looked at him, left home and said, gotcha, sucker, and split. And the book talks about revenge. See, we had a thing in the neighborhood. You know, the kids nowadays say, I don't get mad, I get even, sucker. You know, we used to get mad and get even. You hear what I'm saying? Billy's laughing. He's from this school. He knows what I'm talking about. I can tell you some numbers I did on people in my younger days you wouldn't believe. I went off to the service. There was nothing outstanding about my service career, other than the fact I was in the second wave of intel when I was 17 years old. I came back a combat veteran at the age of 19. I was stationed at the Kaneohe Marine Air Station in Honolulu, Hawaii. I also picked up a little. I was a jock. I picked up a few things along the way. I boxed a little bit. I had a good teacher. His name was Tony Zale, former middleweight champ of the world. I was all Marine Corps runner-up light hip. My drinking did not interfere with my short four-year military career. I never got in any serious difficulty other than the normal humbugs. I made the brig a few times. I didn't always get in trouble when I drank. But every time I got in trouble, I had been drinking. Check that one out. You guys that ain't sure if you're an alcoholic, check that one out. Every time I got in trouble, I've been drinking. I have over 60 arrests on my record, on my police record, and I have never had a pair of handcuffs put on me sober. Check that one out. I came out of the service, and I had some offers to become a professional boxer. There were some people in Chicago called the Syndicate. They wanted to back me to become a pro fighter. Tony Zale and a few other people that loved me enough to tell me the truth told me I wouldn't make it because I have very brittle hands, and they advised me against it. So I did the next best thing. I got married. I couldn't become a pro fighter, so I got married. And I already told you that my neighborhood was all Polish and Italian people. And I married a beautiful fox by the name of Ellen Teresa Riley. Yes, black hair, green eyes. Shaped like this, beautiful, mean and cat shit. And she loved me. I mean, that woman was crazy about me. Of course, see, in those days, I had all my hair, my real teeth, no glasses, didn't have all this, you know. Hot fox, you know. But very humble. And that's a long time ago, too. We weren't married too long, she became pregnant. Meantime, I had to make a buck, you know, because you got to pay the rent and you got to take care of your responsibilities. So I said, what am I going to do for a living? I can't punch people out no more. You know, what can I do? So guess what I did? I took a little inventory about myself. I didn't know what it was then, you know. But, you know, I like people and I'm a personable guy and I got a good sense of humor. So I became a bartender, you know. I became a bartender because I like people, right? Wrong. Lying motherfucker. Hate people. Love booze. Love booze. Yeah. And my wife got pregnant, and then we had the baby girl, Sherry. Beautiful bundle from heaven. And I kept drinking more and more and more. And my alcoholism progressed as it always does. And my behavior got worse and worse. And I kept coming home later and later with all those telltale signs on my person that I'd been out fucking around. And I know my old lady had never heard of Al-Anon because I had never heard of AA or nothing. But somehow, some way, God had been watching her for a long time. And I showed up one night. Around 3 in the morning, I mean messed up, man. I got off at 6, and I show up around 3, and hi there, you know. And she said to me, listen up, chump. In the morning, the baby and I are history. And I said, what you talking about? She says, we're leaving you. In the morning, we're gone. Bye-bye time. And I said, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Where's your fucking gratitude at? I mean, them 3 pieces of furniture we got from Polk Brothers are almost paid for. We got 2 cans of tuna fish and 6 pounds of Polish sausage in the icebox. I know we got $6 cash money up there in that jar. Where's your gratitude at? That was my attitude, and she said, bye. And in the morning, I went to work. I came home, and that night, they were gone, man. She wasn't jiving. Cookie jar was gone with the money. Polish sausage was gone. Tuna fish was gone. The only thing that was left was all my clothes and 1 big pile on the telephone. And I said, the nerve of that son of a bitch. And I got what all alcoholics need the worst, man. I got a resentment. Yeah, you know. So I started drinking at her and drinking at things. And I got to the point where my alcoholism progressed to the point where I could not get a job on the south side of Chicago tending bar. And they got some real toilets on the south side of Chicago, folks. And I got hooked up with a couple old boyhood buddies that I grew up with, 2 Italian kids. One kid was named Frankie Fermella. The other kid named was Vince Canova. Now, Frankie Fermella was a smack freak, a heroin addict, and had been since he was 14 years old. He'd been mainlining that shit. I owe Frankie. To this day, I owe Frankie because, well, you know, Frankie, he was so bad. That dude was so bad. In those days, you know, the only place you could send a gouster in those days, we used to call them gousters. Now you call yourself dope fiends, you understand? In those days, the old timers used to call them gousters, you know. See, I did everything before it was fashionable. I did grass back in the fucking days when they didn't even call it grass. They used to call it gauge, you understand? And if they caught you with a roach in your possession, you bought a nickel in the joint, period. If they bought you with 2 roaches, you got 15 years flat for possession for sale. You understand? Yeah. That's how I'm older than dirt. You hear what I'm saying? I go back. And I used to send Frankie to Lexington, Kentucky to clean up. And he'd go down there for 6 months and he'd come back, he'd be looking like Mr. America. And 2 weeks later, he'd come in, hey, man, what's happening about you? And I said, Frankie, you're doing that shit again, man. What is it with you and heroin? And besides that, you ripped off my Grundig Majestic stereo set, you sucker. And I'm supposed to be your partner. And he'd say, Paz. He'd say, man, let me tell you about heroin, man. He'd say, heroin will make you wear summer clothes in the wintertime. Yeah. See, that don't mean nothing to you Californians. Try Chicago when that hawk is out and it's 20 below. Ooh, Lord. Open-toed sandals in the snow. Hey, Papa, what's happening? Yeah, you know. Take a walk down State Street sometime, that great street, and check it out. But white pork lemon juice was cool. You hear what I'm saying? Yeah, out of a brown bag. Do you guys know the difference between a wino and a connoisseur? See, a connoisseur takes the bottle out the bag before he drinks it. Just a little humor there. You know. Anyhow, all 3 of us, me and Vinny were winos, and Frankie's a smack freak, and we're busted, and we got to get some money. And there's an expression in our neighborhood that says, if you ain't working, you're stealing. So guess what we did? Got 2 winos and a smack freak, and we got us a master plan. Yeah. The Chicago Tribune later would... would refer to us in the headline as the Coffee Break Gang. And I'll run this down there real quick. We took a job at the New York Central Railroad as gandy dancers. Now, gandy dancers are people that work on the railroad tracks in the wintertime, and you sweep off the snow off the tracks and melt the switches so that the trains can go choo-choo. And the only reason we took the job was we knew in front that the railroad was very liberal in the coffee breaks, used to give you a half hour in the morning, hour for lunch, and a half hour in the afternoon. See, and we got this master plan. So what we used to do on our breaks is go stick up savings and loan associations. Yeah, I'm talking armed robbery. I ain't talking no Starsky and Hutch. I'm talking the real thing. Walk in and say, give me your money. And hold the peace out there. And they gave us the money. Yeah, we made two banks in 3 days and got away with it. Clean. Now, let me tell you how hip, slick, and cool I was. I had $58,000 cash money in my pocket, and I'm still drinking white port and lemon juice. Yeah, that tells you how bad I was, right? Penitentiaries are full of lanes like that. Now, dig this. Now, we even press our luck. We go back the fourth day to make the third joint. We don't know. We ain't hip to the fact, you know, that the Chicago's loaded with precincts, police departments. They got maps and they, you know, they got walls and maps and they put pins in the maps, you know, and you form what's known as a pattern. We don't know none of that. We're too fucked up to know that. So the next day, we walk into the Woodlawn Savings and Loan Association, walk in and say, hello, this is it. And I never heard so much shooting since Korea. Yeah, my man Frankie was standing about 1 foot to my left, and he bought it. They gave him a third eye, and he's history on the spot. And Vinny and I shot our way out of the joint. Got away. Found out later the only reason we got away, he shot our way out. The two dicks that were staking out the joint were rookie cops, and they were afraid as we were. And we split up. Vinny went his way, I went my way. They picked up Vinny, took him downtown, hung him on the door. Beat a cha-cha on his ass. He told him he shot McKinley, Martin Luther King, and John F. Kennedy, and I was with him. Yeah. When I got to this program, they started talking to me about trust, and I said, later, sucker. I don't want to hear nothing about no trust. That's when I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1959. I was in the Cook County Jail in Chicago awaiting transfer to the penitentiary. And I was a maximum security risk. And it was cold in that jail in November. Cold, man. I'm talking cold. And a screw came by, the hack came by, and he said, you want to go to the meeting tonight? And I said, what meeting? He said, there's an AA meeting in the chapel. And I said, what's that? He said, they got free coffee and cigarettes. I said, right on. Yeah, so they put me in shackles, and they took me to my very first meeting, and I remember it like it was yesterday. Because I remember shuffling into the chapel, and I remember... In those days, you know, they used to barbecue people. See, capital punishment was in. And they, Cook County is where they did it all. And they had death row, and they had the electric chair outside of death row. In order to get in the chapel, you had to pass this. And for the AA meetings, I don't know why, but they used to uncover the electric chair. I don't know why they did that. And I remember shuffling by death row in the chair, and I remember walking in and sitting in the pew. And I remember the coffee was black, and it was sweet, and it was hot. I remember the cigarettes were Pall Malls, and they were free, and they were loose. And I remember sticking my pockets full of these squares because, and saying, what a bunch of assholes these AA dudes were, man. Had to be some kind of a trick, you know, because anyone give me all the coffee I can handle, and all the squares that I can, got to be some kind of a trick, you know. And besides that, don't want to hear nothing about no alcoholism. Ain't no alcoholic. I just gotten cracked for doing something that was sociably unacceptable. And I got some hard time to do because I bought a 5 to 15 in the penitentiary. And get away from me, fool. That was my attitude. The book talks about it. The book knew I was coming. Talks about belligerent denial. They knew this Pollock was going to be here. Wrote about me long before I got here. Went off to the penitentiary. Did 6 years in the penitentiary and got cut loose. 6 years ain't much time compared to some people. It's a long time for me. 6 years of living in constant fear.
6 years of living in a constant fear and not be able to tell a single soul you're scared because you'd be somebody's old lady by morning. 6 years of walking slow and drinking a lot of water. If a motherfucker comes within 1 foot of you, you cut him. Or you hit him with a pipe. I ain't going back to prison no more. Give me an amen for that.
Amen. Amen.
One of the stipulations of my parole, one of them, I had two stipulations. One, that I go to St. Leonard's House, a halfway house for ex-convicts on Chicago's west side. Number two is I go on Anabuse. And I said, wait a minute, what's this Anabuse shit? The dude says, you'll either take it or you'll stay here. I says, I'll take anything, I'll sign this, let me go. And I went to St. Leonard's House. They had 60 ex-convicts under one roof, run by an Episcopal priest named Father James G. Jones. And there was around 16 of us drunks in there, you understand, alcoholics that were on Anabuse. And every morning, Father Jones used to come by and he'd pop that Anabuse in us like communion. And the little dude behind him, you know, with the tray of orange juice, you know. And you know, the book talks about alcohol being cunning, baffling, and powerful. Well, I'm here to tell you that alcoholics, practicing alcoholics, are cunning and baffling also. Because what I would do as soon as we got my Anabuse is, I would go outside and I'd lose my Anabuse before it got in there. And then I'd go down and get me a couple tall dogs of white port, knock them down, and come back about an hour later singing, hey, Bob, a rebound, everyone say, man, look at Paz. Paz is crazy, man. Paz is drinking behind Anabuse. He's going to get sick and die. But no, I wasn't going to get sick and die. I didn't have no Anabuse in me. I was getting over on him, right? Wrong. Father Jones says, you're fucked up, you're drinking in my house, you're jeopardizing my house, everyone in it, get out. And I left. The middle of winter, Chicago, Illinois, without a dime in my pocket, no place to go. Too proud to call a single soul for some help. So I went the only place I could go. I went to the streets. Madison and Des Plaines on the west side of Chicago is the second most infamous skid row in these United States next to the Bowery. And I existed down there for a year and a half. Existed down there for a year and a half, singing for my supper at the Sally, pearl diving for a Greek for $3 a day and 2 packages of cigarettes, sleeping on the sidewalks wrapped up in cardboard and newspaper with a bottle of white port on my hip. That's one of the things that alcohol did for me. And one day, you know, I'm going to tell you something. One day I got sick and tired of being sick and tired that way. I really did. I took an in-depth look at myself. I know what it's called now. It's called an inventory. And I took my very first inventory. And I got down the causes and conditions, and I decided what my problem was. It was Chicago. Yeah, Chicago sucks, man. Man can't even get a job in Chicago, you understand? Don't like me because I'm an ex-con. You hear what I'm talking about? Of course, if you can't get a job in Chicago, you ain't got a pulse beat. You know what I'm saying? Manufacturing capital of the world. Took my first geographic, got on the bus, Gus, as they say. Woke up in Lincoln, Nebraska. Never been in Lincoln, Nebraska before. Drank a little wine on the way to Lincoln, Nebraska. Got off. I didn't know. See, I'll tell you, I don't know why I went to Lincoln. If I knew then what I knew now, I'd never go to Lincoln. Lincoln, Nebraska is a university town. It's also a Seventh-day Adventist town. Seventh-day Adventists don't believe in nothing. They don't. They don't believe in smoking, drinking. They don't even make love standing up because they don't want anyone to think they're dancing, you know. And Paz arrives drunk, right? Yeah, I get off the bus, take around 3 steps, trip over mats, and I'm in jail. Drunk tank, Lincoln, Nebraska. I'm in there with 6 drunken Sioux Indians. Right on, swear to God. They ain't never seen a Polack before. Didn't know what a Polack was, man. The only night I ever spent my life in jail where I didn't sleep. Had my eye open. Thought them cats were gonna have some kind of a ceremony or something with me. Yeah, but they were just alcoholics like I was. In the morning we got our kick out. We hit the alleys and we started drinking that wine and dropping them reds and Nimitol and Seconal. I did that one for about a month and I can't understand what happened. I got awfully depressed, man. Drinking that wine, dropping them dollars, and I got depressed, man. I started crying. Don't know why. Drank that wine, dropped them pills. Got more depressed, you understand? So I tried what all alcoholics try, not all alcoholics, but a lot of us try to do sometime. I tried my first suicide attempt. They told me later I almost chopped my hands off. Glad to show any of you the scars after the meeting unashamedly, because that's what it took for me to get here and stay here. I woke up in a hospital in a cage in a bed with bars on it and leather restraints. Asked the nurse where I was. She says, "You're in the hospital." I said, "What happened?" She said, "You tried to hang it up." All of a sudden, the door opened up and a little old lady came in, looked like Hedda Hopper or Luella Parsons. Had a coat on and one of them flowery hats, a little attaché case. She came up to me. She says, "Good morning, Mr. Pozniak." She said, "How do you feel?" I said, "Where'd you get that fucking hat?" And see, she didn't laugh, you understand. She just opened up this briefcase she had and took out these papers and signed them, and I was committed. See, I didn't know the lady was a shrink. I didn't know that. Yeah. Yeah, and they, what happens, see, let me tell you something. See, when you try to attempt suicide, don't fuck it up. Because if you do, it's against the law. Did you know that? Attempted suicide is against the law, and you're under arrest legally. And what they do is they run a check on you, understand? And they pulled my rap sheet and found out I was a felon. So they put me in a place called the Lincoln State Hospital for the criminally insane. Yeah, I'm in a nut house, you understand? Yeah, anyone here see the movie Cuckoo's Nest? Yeah, that was me. Yeah, that's my story. They made a film out of that sucker, didn't know it. Yeah, I'm in the Lincoln State Hospital for the criminally insane. 17 electric shock treatments, various forms of chemotherapy, hydrotherapy, psychotherapy, liquid Thorazine, walking around, talking to the squirrels. "Hey, baby, what's happening?" Yeah, completely fucked up. The book calls that the easier, softer way. But I want you to know I wasn't an alcoholic. I was not an alcoholic. See, I was a manic depressive. I was an anxiety neurotic with schizophrenic tendencies. Because that's what the dude in the white coat told me I was. And that's what I wanted to be, you understand? Because I did not want to be an alcoholic. I did not want to be an alcoholic because my mama was an alcoholic. And my mama died from alcoholism, chronic alcoholism, at the age of 42, beat half to death. And I didn't want nothing to do with that, so I belligerently denied it. I left Nebraska, bad town, bad state. Got on the bus, wound up in San Francisco, California. Never been there before, you know. Found a little saloon with a pool table in it called McCarthy's. Walked in there with my $32 cash. About 2 hours later, I had $200. Found my way to the Palace Billiards on the edge of the Tenderloin. Built that $200 into $1,500 and had $1,500 and a couple friends. One of them was a dude named Gus Hiller, who owned the square chair, the round table, the Why Not, and the Club Marie on the corner of Eddie and Leavenworth. Tenderloin, San Francisco, California. If the whole world was in the shape of an animal, that would be the anus. Yeah. I'm here to tell you, folks, I lived and worked in San Francisco, California for 5 years and never once saw the Golden Gate Bridge, Candlestick Park, the Oakland Coliseum, the Cow Palace, the Civic Auditorium, or any of that. I was too busy taking care of business. Never got out of the Mission, never got out of Noe Valley. The first time I saw the Golden Gate Bridge, I was going across it in a bus with bars on it. I was on my way to Mendocino State Hospital Alcoholism Program. Anybody here ever been to Mendocino? Right on. I love it. I love it. That's my newest baby. We got something in common, right? I had to work at Mendocino State Hospital. Guess what I did? Everyone had a job up there. Guess what I did? I was a lifeguard because I'm a good swimmer. I was a lifeguard in the nut house. Yeah, that's right. They got a swimming pool up there. Water's only 3 feet deep. But I was a lifeguard up there. It wasn't all that bad, though, while I was up there. See, I fell in love while I was up there, you understand? I met a lady that was up there, and this poor lady, God love her, I have fond memories of her. She told me she was a new widow. Her husband had just croaked. He was in the ground, but he was still warm, you know. He wasn't even cold yet. And she told me that he had left her $45,000 cash money, insurance money, and $120,000 home in Mill Valley, California. And this is going back quite a few years. It's probably worth $500,000 now. And she was lonely. And I said, oh, you poor thing. I said, you know what we ought to do? You and me ought to take a pass, and we ought to go to your place in Mill Valley and talk. And she said, I knew you'd understand. Right? So that lady took me home with her, Mill Valley, California. And that first night was out of sight. I'm here to tell you I violated that woman like I ain't never violated a soul in my life. I'm here to tell you that woman loved me. That's not a commercial. That's just a fact. In the morning, she gave away a German Shepherd she had for 10 years because I didn't like him. That's right. That woman used to give me $200 a day, every day, for walking around money. And I drink it. I was with that woman for 5 years. And then I split. Number one, she drank too much. And number two, she didn't bathe too much towards the end. This is after we drank up the insurance money and the house. And besides that, she was broke. See? That's the kind of a staunch human being I used to be. I could go on and on with my drunk log, and I'm here to tell you right now that I have tried every treatment or modality known to man for the arrestment of alcoholism, and none of them worked for me. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I've been through aversion therapy. I've been through psychotherapy. I've been on end abuse. I've had it all. AA works for me. God sent me to San Jose, California in 1975, and I woke up underneath the pickup truck behind Babe Griffin's in my hospital pajamas because I had just escaped from the Synanon-based program called The Family up in Menlo Park. That works. That program works. It worked for me for about 5 minutes. They put me in the hot seat, start talking about my mom, and I like to kill about four of them and split. When I got to San Jose, they told me if I wanted to get sober, all they had to do was lay down on the street, the cop would pick me up and take me out to E&R at Agnew. So I did that one. They took me out to Agnew for 3 days, detoxed me, and shot me into a recovery house called the Lighthouse, downtown on San Fernando Street. Billy remembers it. One of the parts of the program there was AA meetings. They were mandatory, and you had to go to AA meetings. And I used to go to AA meetings, and I used to stand up and say, my name is Paz, I'm an alcoholic. And tell my sick fucking jokes and try to get next to some of the ladies. I never read the book. I never worked a step. I never got a sponsor. Somehow, some way, I managed to stay dry for 7 months. But the result was inevitable. I was to drink again. Only this time, the timing was bad. See, all these years of being a practicing alcoholic had finally taken its toll on me physically. This athletic body that I had that God gave me dissipated to the point where I developed coronary arterial sclerosis, blockage of the arteries, and I had to have open heart surgery. And I went up to Palo Alto, California, and I had 4 bypasses. And I was on the table for 8 hours, and I was in intensive care for 10 days. I almost didn't make it. I almost did not make it because you're only supposed to be in intensive care for 2 days. On the 11th day, they released me from the hospital, and they sent me home, and they gave me a 55-gallon drum full of Percodan. And told me if it hurts, take some of these. And I said, right on. Right on. And I went home and I was sitting in my robe. I was sitting in my robe one Saturday morning watching a baseball game. And all of a sudden a guy hit a home run and I started crying. Because I'm sitting there eating this Percodan like popcorn. The dude hit a home run and I'm crying. See, I'm depressed again, you understand? I don't know why. You know, and I'm steady eating this Percodan. Okay? And then you know what I said to myself? Man, I must be going nuts. I'm sitting here watching a goddamn ball game, and I'm praying, man. Maybe if I just take one little drink, just one little drink, man, maybe I'll feel better, right? Just one. And I did. That's what I took, was one. Just one drink, man. And I was drunk for 8 months around the clock, 24 hours a day. My heart enlarged twice its normal size. I went up to 272 pounds. I looked like a fat Chinaman. And I almost died. One morning about 4 o'clock, I called Jack Holt, who is now my sponsor. See, I had then and I have now what's known as congestive heart failure, in my case, an irreparable condition that I have to live with. And every time I lie down drunk, my lungs would fill up with fluid, and I would drown in my own fluids. And I called Jack about 4 o'clock one morning, and I said, "Jack, I think I'm dying. I heard angel feathers." And Jack said, "Fuck you, die." He said, "You want to drink? Die." He says, "You want to live?" He says, "Come back to this fellowship." It's called tough love. It's called tough love. I found out later on that Jack stayed up all night crying and praying for my ugly ass. And don't get me started on the power of prayer, because that's why I'm here tonight. I'm alive and I'm sober. I'm getting my health back because of people praying for me. I made a decision to jump into this program with both feet. I grabbed some shirt tails and I hung on. And I say shirt tails because I believe, as was handed down to me, that the boys get sober with the boys and the girls get sober with the girls. And later on, when you got your shit together, if you want to go jump on each other's bones, that's cool. You know, I believe that. Okay? Making love, relationships are fantastic in addition to the program, not instead of. I've seen more people get fucked up behind relationships, man. How can you love someone else when you don't love yourself? How can you know someone else when you don't even know yourself? Give yourself some time. Give yourself a break. My sponsor's a book man. My sponsor's a step man. He handed me this book and said, "Here, find your own program." And he suggested I start on page 25, where it says, "There is a solution, the leveling of the pride. Almost no one amongst us like the self-searching, the revealing of our shortcomings to another, which the process requires for its successful consummation." Requires for its successful consummation. It doesn't say, "Maybe I should think about it." It don't say that. It says requires. Then I got into chapter 3, more about alcoholism. And that's where I found what's commonly referred to as the step before the steps. Where it says, in the second paragraph, first sentence, where we learn that we have to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. That's the first step in recovery, period. That's what it says. And concedes for me, pass, to look in a mirror and look behind my eyes, down into my guts, into my innermost self and say, "Man, you can't handle that shit no more." That's a concession on my part. Then I got into the first step. The minute I was powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. I had no problem looking at the unmanageability of my life. All I had to do was look at the record. Powerless. Powerless. See you later. Hated that word, powerless. I could not be powerless. I was not powerless over anything. Because you hadn't done what I did, go where I went and survive and be powerless. But I didn't take nothing. I kept going to their meetings and I kept listening to you people. I kept listening to my spots, and all of a sudden it occurred to me, I am powerless over alcohol, man. I cannot take one drink and guarantee my behavior. And that's a fact. That's a fact. You know, sober, I ain't a bad guy. I'm not. So many people may not think so. That's cool. That's all right. Take a number. You know? But I'll tell you what, there's a few people in here that see me drunk. Ask them how I am. I'm a saint now compared to what I used to be, right? Right on. Step 2 came to me with a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. Had a real hang up with that one. God. My God was a gotcha God. I didn't want to hear nothing about no gods. My God was the God that they taught me about at that school that I told you I went to. He was a punishing God, a fearful God, a God that stayed up there somewhere in heaven behind a cloud, behind a tree and watched me. You understand? You know, yeah, watch me close, man, you know. And every time I got an impure thought or masturbated or something, he'd say, "Gotcha! Ah, gotcha, sucker!" You know, Yeah, and if I died and I had enough of them gotchas on me, I was going to go to hell and shovel coal for the rest of my life, right? Or if somehow, some way I got a play and was clean when I croaked, I'd go to heaven and blow a harp with Gabriel and them cats or something. I don't know. But you know, God works in strange ways. You know, I've been sober for about a year, and I was a... He thought I was talking Chinese. He don't know what I'm saying, you know. Here I was walking on this beach, and the clouds were out, and the surf was up, the wind was blowing, and I looked at this magnificent piece of God's earth, and it occurred to me, who made this? Who made it? If anyone out there knows the name of the architect that built that, let me know. I want him to do my yard when I make it, when my ship comes in. See, architects didn't make that. God made that, and that's what I became aware of that day. I became that higher power. I became aware of what you people were talking to me about, this force for good, and I had a spiritual experience. I got overcome, and I dropped down on my knees in the bucket of water, and I was crying. And people were walking by and on me saying, look at this dude, man. Weird cat. And I didn't care about him. And I ran back. No, I didn't ran. That's a lie. I never ran anywhere. I walked back to the lodge, and I took the second step with my sponsor. And later on, I got to step three, where I made the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. And I did it like the book said, out loud with another human being. Then I got into step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself, and I said, fuck you. I stopped. I ain't about to write nothing about me on no paper. I ain't going to do it. That's all there is to it. I am not going to reopen that can of worms called my life and re-experience those feelings that kept me drunk for all them years later for you. And if I do, I sure as fuck ain't going to tell nobody like it says in step five. Meantime, my life wasn't going too good. And I would go to my sponsor, Jack, and I'd say, Jack, you know, about this job that I got, man, it ain't talking, Jack. I say, mark step four. I say, Jack, I ain't talking about no step four. I'm talking about my gig, man. See, the job, work step four. I say, Jack, okay, forget the job. Jack, this relationship I have with Joni, you know what I mean? It's driving me nuts, man. I can't deal with it. Work step four. I said, Jack, I ain't talking about no step. I'm talking about my relationship with this lady. I said, you son of a bitch, you've been sober too long. Your hearing's going on you. And Jack, you know how gentle Jack is, right? All right, goddammit. I'm tired of listening to your goddamn sniveling. I'll tell you what you do. You go home, you write that goddamn fourth step, and you have it at my house in 4 weeks, 1 month from today. And I said, wait a minute. Hold it, chump. Where does it say in this book that a sponsor can tell his baby when he's got to have the fourth step done? Who do you think you are, God? 5 weeks later, I should have. I was a little bit defiant in them days. And that's when I found out what a guy my sponsor was, what a truly wonderful man he really is. Jack Holt. My sponsor's coming up on 25 years sobriety this coming March the 6th. And I found out what an understanding, compassionate, beautiful, tough love, ass-kicking specialist he is. Just what God ordered for me. He's the father I never really had. And I love him. I love him dearly. And I can say that now because I'm sober and I'm a member of this fellowship. And I could never tell another man that I loved him before. Not where I was, brother. You'd be in deep shit. But you people told me how to say that and how to feel it and how to mean it. And for that, I'm very grateful. I took the fifth with my sponsor. Then I worked the sixth and seventh steps of this program. Six and seven steps to me are very important. To me, for me, the sixth and seventh steps, and this is only my opinion, as everything else that's been said tonight is only my opinion. I have all kinds of character defects, all kinds of them. And I wrote them down. I became aware of them. I'm very aware of them. And I asked God to take them away from me. I humbly asked him in step seven. But there's some that I keep taking back. And I don't believe I'm ever going to be perfect. The book talks about spiritual progress, not perfection. And for me, I'm just trying to be a better human being today than I was yesterday. That to me is spiritual progress. I got all kinds of character defects. They ain't no St. Paz. They ain't never going to be no St. Paz. And that's the way it is for me. I could talk to you a lot longer about step 6 and 7, how important it is to me today to keep looking at step 6 and 7. In fact, I just recently took another 6th and 7 step because I was insane sober. You hear what I'm saying? And it ain't nobody's business but my own. It ain't no one's fault but my own, okay? I got into step 8 where I made a list of all persons out of harm, became willing to make amends to them all. I had a list that looked like a roll of toilet paper. I put my name at the top of the list because my sponsor told me to do that. Because although I had hurt, used, and abused, and conned, and cajoled, and hustled every human being I'd ever met all my life, I'd hurt myself more than anyone. Then I got to step 9. I made direct amends to such people. The first one I made amends to was myself. I do that one by staying sober one day at a time. Then I had to deal with some biggies. I had to deal with my father. I had to call my father and make amends to my father, not only for what I did to him, but for what I thought of doing to him. Because, see, when I was in the penitentiary for those 6 years, I had made a decision that when I get out, I was going to waste them. I was going to put them in a sewer. I was going to stuff them in a concrete kimono for all the shit he had done to my mama. And I had no right to think that or do that. And I was sober, and I called my father long distance in Chicago, and I told him I was sober, and I called him to make amends for any harm or hurt or any inconsiderate thing I had done to him during his life. And he says, fuck you, you're bullshit. And he called me a punk. At that time, I was 45 years old, and the man called me a punk. And I was hurt. I was crushed. The last words I've ever said to my father was, I love you, and I hung up the phone. I went to my sponsor, and I was crying. And I said, Jack, my dad won't accept my amends. And my Jack told me to scratch his name off the list because I had made amends. He didn't accept them, and it's on him. Next thing I did was make amends to my mother. Now you might say, how did you do that? She's dead. That's right. This only fits for me. I wrote a letter to her. I've never hurt my mother much because, God bless her, she died before I could really nail her. Because I would have nailed her like I nailed everyone else in my life. And I wrote a letter to her telling my innermost feelings about her. And the fact that I finally realized what she had gone through in her life. My mother was a beautiful lady. She was a very Damon Runyon-esque lady. I used to come home from school and she'd say, she'd be all fucked up, half drunk and beat up. She'd say, come on, kid, let's harmonize. Heart of my heart, and we'd sing. And she'd say, always remember, kid, don't ever forget what I'm going to tell you. It ain't a sin to have the crabs, it's a sin to keep them. And I was a kid. And I didn't understand her. I didn't know what she was talking about. Now I ain't a kid, and I know what she was talking about. It ain't a sin to be a drunk. It's a sin to stay one. That's what she was telling me, in her own way. I wrote a letter to her, and I dropped it in the mailbox, addressed anywhere, USA, heaven. No stamp, no return address. And I did that one. Step 10. Continue to take personal inventory. You were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 10, they tell me you can work from the very first day you come into this program. To avoid building another heavy, heavy bag. Okay? Now, when we get here, when I got here, I had a heavy bag of shit. That's the only way I can describe it. Over my shoulder, like all alcoholics have when they arrive here. When we get to step 4, we get rid of this bag of shit. The big, heavy one that we've been carrying around with all them years. Okay? However, step 10 allows me on a daily basis to get rid of the little piles of caca every day. See? From the time I get here, little caca, get rid of that one every day. Because if I don't do it on a daily basis, now all of a sudden I don't get rid of this one in step 4. I got 2 heavy bags of caca, right? And my chances of staying sober are slim. Okay? Step 10 tells me a lot of other things. Step 10 tells me that love and service is our creed. Step 10 tells me that we can no longer have things like revenge. Okay? Step 10 tells me it's no longer people, places, or things. If I got a rock in my gut, it's no longer you guys or this or that. It's me, and I got to check myself out. That's step 10. for me. Step 11 sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him. I am not a saint, and I am not the most spiritual man you will see around these rooms. But I found a higher power in these rooms and in this program, and I choose to call this higher power God. And I talk to my God every day, at least twice a day, usually a lot more. In the morning I get up and I have my morning ritual that I go through. And I use Dr. Fred's prayer where I say, "Good morning, Heavenly Father, thank you for this day of sobriety, freedom, and joy. And thank you for showing me what you would have me do, and for giving me the strength, the courage, and the patience to do thy will." That's the first thing out of my mouth in the morning. When I open my eyes, I say that prayer. It's become a habit. It's a good habit. It's a good habit that has replaced bad habits, which is what this program is all about, too. Then I ask God to direct my thinking for that day. Because left to my own devices, I am going to mess it up. Then I go about my business doing what I think is His will for me. In the morning I say please, and at night I say thank you. I don't go to bed at night without hitting the boards. Hitting the boards, getting down on my knees, and thanking Him for this day of sobriety. And I ask Him to bless all the guys that I'm working with. And I ask Him please for another day of sobriety tomorrow. And I ask Him to keep an eye on those brothers and sisters that are still out there killing their fucking selves with that shit. And I get very emotional behind that. 85% of the guys in the penitentiary, they're not criminals. They're behind drug and alcohol problems. Am I right, Billy? There's a man that works in alcohol. He can tell you. He knows more statistics than I ever dreamt of knowing. That's one that's true. They're beautiful people. They get full of that shit, and they do what they got to do to maintain their jones, to support their habit or their addiction or their alcoholism. They wind up in a fucking joint forever. I am not a born bank robber. I couldn't do anything in that way sober. I had no balls. I had to drink that white port and lemon juice to get the balls to do it. I'm a phony. On the outside, I'm a gorilla. On the inside, I'm a pussy. And I can stand up here tonight and unashamedly tell you that. But I ain't no doormat. I didn't come to this program to become a lady, to step on my toes, and I'm going to let you know about it. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics. And to practice these principles in all our affairs. I had a spiritual awakening. I found a higher power here. I choose to call that higher power God. I try to improve my conscious contact, my God consciousness on a daily basis the best I can. Try to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. When I'm asked, I go. It's just that simple. And I'm also one of these AA meddlers. I will get in your business in a minute. I will love you enough to tell you the truth about yourself and about me. Bottom line in this program for me is one drunk helping another drunk. We both stay sober today. That's how I got here. The man that 12-stepped me this last time I went out is sitting right there. I love him like a brother. Practice these principles in all our affairs. It's very simple. I don't. I try, but I don't. I'm getting better. I'm getting better. I'm a great believer in the word heritage as it applies to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in sponsorship, and I believe in grand sponsorship. My sponsor is Jack Holt, has 25 years. My grand sponsor is Al Lee. He's coming up on 32 years in July. Both of these men have been a tremendous force in my life. They've taught me a lot. And I finally became teachable after many, many, many years of not being teachable. And that's a secret. I go to a lot of men's meetings and I work with a lot of new men. But I would also be very remiss in not talking about some of the women friends that I have in this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have many platonic friends in this program, sisters under the gin. But there was one lady in particular. Her name was Joni. She was my former wife, my late wife, who died 9 years sober in this fellowship. And I love her so much. and she gave so much to me. When she went, she took a part with me, a part of me with her. She's up there in heaven with my mama, if there's a place called heaven. Joni taught me about loving. Joni taught me that a practicing alcoholic is incapable of loving because love is giving. Love is giving, and you are what you give. Ask yourselves today, what have I given to this fellowship that saved my ass lately? What have I given? And I ain't talking about no fucking dollar bill, all right, or a quarter or whatever. What have you given another human being today? That's what love's all about. And that woman taught me that. Al tells me that there's three parts of this program if you want to attain and maintain a comfortable sobriety. Number one is the higher power that we have to use on a daily basis. All three parts on a daily basis if we want to attain and maintain a comfortable sobriety. Number one is the higher power as you choose to understand it. Secondly is this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've alluded to tonight. And last but not least is the people. The people. People. People helping people are the luckiest people in the world. That's what Barbara Streisand said in the song from Funny Girl. The first time I heard it, I cried. I was stoned. Bitch can wail, man. Got a lot of heart. Let me tell you about people, okay? There's two kinds of people in this world. There's people like us in rooms like this tonight all over the world. And then there's the other people out there, okay? I'm going to talk about those other people out there, okay? Those friends that I thought I had out there. Let me tell you about those people out there. You know what those people out there give a fuck about? This is what they give a fuck about right here. They give about this, okay? If you ain't got this out there, you ain't shit. And if you don't believe me when we say amen tonight, drag your ass over to the local gin mill, put your ass on a stool, and order a drink. And then when the dude brings it, drink it, and tell him you ain't got no money. Now, if you're as ugly as me and Don, you're going to be in a world of trouble. Yeah. But if you're foxy like some of these ladies around here, you understand, you're going to get your drink free, right? Wrong. You're going to pay for it before the night's over, and you ladies know what I'm talking about because you've been there. See, then you got the other people. You got the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Who don't give a shit who you are or where you came from. All they care about is that you're an alcoholic. You want to do something about your life. AA is the only place in the world I know where you come through the door with your pecker hanging out and chili on your shoes, your boobs exposed, stink, tell everybody you're going to steal everything they got, and someone's going to say, welcome, brother or sister. You're in the right spot. Sit down, have a cup of coffee, and shut up. I'm a very fortunate man. I have a million friends in this fellowship who love me and accept me for what I am unconditionally. And I love and accept them unconditionally. Today, my life is good. I went through a rough time this past holiday season. The thought of drinking never occurred to me. God was watching me. I went crazy at meetings. I threw chairs across meeting rooms. I threatened the whole men's group one Monday night because I was nuts. And the reason I was nuts was because I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing on a daily basis rather than what I wanted to do. It's called self-pity. It's called anger. It's called resentment. And I walked through that one sober. Thanks to you people, that book, God and His Fellowship. I'm going to close now with a poem. Before you run out, it ain't no heavy poem. And I didn't write it. A lady named Thelma G. from San Jose wrote it. It just happens to be my story. And hopefully you can identify with it. It's entitled How It Works. And it says very simply, utter confusion, misery and pain, humiliation, remorseful and shame, dreading to face the light of the day and not wanting to hear what people would say, like, where is your willpower? Where is your pride? They don't understand that deep down inside I wish I knew the answers to give for how to find the courage to live. I had taken the pills they told me I should. I tried all the cures, but they did no good. I made many promises and meant them too, but the compulsion to drink is stronger than you. One day a friend happened to say, I know the answer, I can show you a way. All it takes is an open mind and believe what you hear from your very own kind. So I went to a meeting and they read chapter 5. The steps made some sense and hope was revived. I saw living proof of what faith can do. It worked for them, why not for you? One day at a time, they told me to live. They said, easy does it and learn to forgive. Be humble, be honest, and help when you can, and pass on what you learned to a brand new man. I heard them repeat the serenity prayer and soon realized all my answers were there. And now, when someone asks, can miracles be? May I always reply, take a look at me. Thank you all for 12-stepping me tonight.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.